You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 7th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
President Putin and I have been discussing various things, and I think it's going very well. We've had some very, very good talks. We're going to have a talk now, and obviously that will continue. It's an honor to be with you.
What could possibly go wrong? Donald Trump meets Vladimir Putin in Hamburg. My guests Carlotta Rebello, Chris Lord and Tom Edwards will be discussing this and the day's other top stories, including the disintegration of talks aimed at reintegrating Cyprus, the ongoing attempts of Paris to accommodate and or relocate its growing migrant population, Vienna's consideration of the question of whether one ugly tower spoils the views of a whole beautiful city, and the year's weirdest books. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Monocle's Carlotta Rebello, Tom Edwards and Chris Lord. Welcome all. And we will start in Hamburg, presently hosting the G20 summit and therefore the first meeting of US President Donald Trump with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Students of Trump's handshake technique are now pondering what is signified by the double pat on the under forearm with the left hand. Both men spoke of their wish to repair ties between the two countries, as people always do at these things. Carlotta, on the scale of strange Trump handshakes, where did this one rank?
I think none of the handshakes that will follow will ever top the Shinzo Abe handshake. It was still
that was a glorious moment.
That was one of the best because it was so bad.
He only recently let go of him, in fact.
how the story goes.
Shinzo Abe must be just running around G20 hiding every time Trump hooves into view.
But it is interesting to see, sorry to jump in here, but how, you know, the G20 and has become just a place for the symbolism. It always has been for the photo ops and the smiling and the meetings that always go according to plan. But how we monitoring the handshake, or if the Polish first lady didn't shake his hand, it has just become a bit too much.
And Chris, is this what we've got another 3.5 years of, basically every international summit turning into the Donald Trump show?
I have to agree with Carlotta there, in as much as, you know, I don't know really in today's various punditry about what's gone on in G20 summit and all that kind of thing, we don't really get that much takeaway from it, right? I mean, we don't learn that much about changes in geopolitical politics and, you know, in sort of relations between these two countries. You know, the most important thing we've probably heard all day is Trump say, it's an honour to be with you, to Vladimir Putin. I mean, that is probably the greatest takeaway of the day. I mean, just showing you how the world leader of, you know, how the leader of the US is so out of touch with the way that, you know, his counterparts in Europe would address somebody like Vladimir Putin. But I think, you know, in terms of this sort of, you know, turning every international summit into a circus, I think it's a problem because quite often, you know, what on earth is the point of these things then if quite often all they end up descending into is, as Carlotta says, who's shaking hands with who, what's Trump going to do to make it? Look at what happened in the NATO meeting when he sort of pushed his way through with the Montenegro prime minister. It just shows you that, you know, that whole summit came to basically nothing in our understanding of what it's all about. It basically became about Trump pushing his way through a crowd.
And then weeks later, when Montenegro was announced that it was joining NATO, everyone was referring back to that. It's like, oh, how good Montenegro must feel now, you know, the country that was pushed away by Donald Trump. And it's not about that. Montenegro didn't become a member of NATO because of what happened there, but it completely sidetracks what matters in the conversation.
Tom Edwards, Trump and Putin did have a private meeting behind closed doors at which the imagination can only boggle. Are relations between the United States and Russia really that bad, though? Or do both sides, for their own reasons, just kind of enjoy creating the impression that they're bad?
I think it's probably mainly the latter. I think what is interesting, of course, you look at the...
Russia in particular needs an enemy, doesn't it?
Well, quite. And you look at the history of relationship between the two countries, and they've been at times when they definitely couldn't even got together to shake hands and to sit down together. So I think it's positive that they talk. Who knows what goes on behind closed doors? I think the important thing with these things is, yeah, on the day, the coverage is dominated by who won the body language battle, and it does look like it's a bit of a circus. But again, it'll take a few days, maybe a few weeks, to realise what was the true substance of their meeting, the one-on-one behind closed doors. And it's funny people were mentioning that NATO meeting. You know, I tell you what, 6 months ago, people were saying, is NATO finished? Is it irrelevant? You know, Trump has contempt for it. And yet, actually, now NATO seems to be increasingly relevant again. And Trump himself seems to have slightly warmed to the idea of what NATO is and what it represents. And that's happened over time. Who knows? Maybe that's happened a little bit, because in some of these bilaterals, some of these leaders who are maybe a bit smarter than him have managed to impress on him, actually, this is something that matters. So I think it's a bit easy to knock the G20 meeting and say, look, this is a joke, it's a circus, why even hold it where it is? You know, we've seen people, riot police and protesters and all this kind of thing. But actually, the real value may only become apparent a little later. So I know it's a bit of a cop-out, but you'd rather have to wait and see to see what the value, if any, is of the meeting between Trump and Putin.
The only thing I would say on that point, though, Tom, is, you know, you mentioned there about the you know, 6 months ago we were all hand-wringing about the future of NATO. Is this going to be the problem when we see now in this increasing media buzz and international focus on things like body language and handshakes and the pleasantries of the whole thing, is that we actually don't know anymore, really. So Trump says that a few days ago that Russian aggression towards Crimea is bad. What's happening there is terrible. The annexation is still a problem. He talks about reaffirming the importance of Article 5 in NATO. He talks all these pro-NATO things. Then he meets with the leader of Russia and says what an honour it is to meet him. It's so garbled because what inevitably we get faced with is this sort of barrage of information about on this absolutely superficial level of handshakes and pleasantries and all this sort of stuff, rather than the actual meat of what's come out of it. But you're right to say, let's wait and see what happens. But I think on the NATO thing, if anything, what this shows of one takeaway we can take from it is that there is no substance to Trump himself when he has and makes these statements. It can shift from day to day.
Well, let's move on now and take a look at Cyprus, where there has been optimism about the possibility of a settlement that might reunify the divided island, or rather had been optimism. The talks have collapsed following the sort of exchange of views which wincing diplomats describe as full and frank. The most recent talks, held in Switzerland, appear to have foundered on Turkey's refusal to countenance a withdrawal of troops from the island, the northern half of which, of course, Turkey seized in 1974. Carlotta, this was supposed to be going well, wasn't it? The Cyprus thing. There'd been the whole Cyprus Spring narrative, cause for optimism, etc., etc., new dawn, and now this.
Well, it can never be easy when you're talking about a 43-year-old dispute. But yes, it had been the most promising developments and talks ever in generations. But I don't know if it has a lot to do still with the memory, you know, as you mentioned, it has been quite recently. So is the memory of how Cyprus was before for older generations what's keeping these talks stalled? You know, it was actually the best chance at reunification, you know, since it was split. And the fact that, you know, you had Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, flying in last minute to speak to both sides of the table, Mike Pence phoning in as well, saying, this is your chance. After this, we can't see when this will happen again. And for everything to collapse, reportedly around 2-3 a.m., I mean, shouting across the table.
Voices were apparently raised.
It is not a good signal, no.
Chris, you are, of course, recently back from Istanbul, where you had been manning our local bureau there. How big a deal is Northern Cyprus to Turkey? Because I was in Cyprus a couple of years ago for the magazine, and the view on both sides of the border was that divide had become increasingly meaningless, especially to people born since 1974. There are, of course, ongoing disputes about people who lost property when travelling from one side of the island to the other in the 70s, etc., etc. But I got the impression from a lot of people I spoke to in Northern Cyprus that given the choice between part of Cyprus and within the EU and sort of broken down adjunct of Turkey, they would rather the former.
Throughout the 20th century, Cyprus was a great way to get nationalists on side. So whether that was rallying people together in Istanbul to go and stand outside the Greek consulate and make a lot of noise and be threatening towards a consul there in Istanbul. You know, if you talk to the consul general there and previous consul generals, they will all have those stories about how when a politician in Turkey was starting to flag to bring up the old Cyprus thing and rattle the saber a little bit, as it were, was a great way to get people back on side. Now, Erdogan, the president of Turkey, knows this all too well. I think what your point is actually really interesting, Andrew, about how much it actually has influence today. And I, to be very honest with you, I actually think that a lot of the fire has come out of that these days. The generation that is there now in Turkey don't actually have that animosity towards the Greeks that was so powerful for previous generations, that was so manipulated by politicians. So I think that has actually fallen out. And in fact, I can tell you for a fact, I spoke to the consul general only 6 months ago in Istanbul, and he said the same, a similar thing. What I think is the case here, I think this is, again, we see Erdogan, you know, playing to a sort of very explosive part of society that is still there. There is still far-right nationalism in Turkey that's very, very strong and believes that Cyprus is inherently a part of the Turkish Republic. But also, I think this is an opportunity of him, for him to sort of show once again how the West has let things fall apart. If you look at the reason about why this has fallen apart, it's the red line that Turkey is basically always stuck to, is that if there is a reunification, we are allowed to keep some Turkish soldiers on Cyprus. That is the red
line. This was apparently one of the sticking points last night while voices were raised and teacups were being hurled.
And that's it. That is the sticking point. And it always is. This is what it always breaks down to. I think Erdogan, when he has that, he has the opportunity once again to turn around to his supporters and say, look, I'm trying to protect our people and they won't let me. They won't allow a deal for reunification whereby our soldiers can protect our Turkish brothers on the north of Cyprus. And this is great political acumen for him. But I would say, I think that impact that it has is just not as strong in that generation now. I think he's looking a bit out of touch, if that's the game he's playing.
Well, it was interesting as well to see how you're mentioning the troops. We're talking about around 40,000 soldiers, Turkish soldiers, that have always been more or less permanent in Cyprus. And one of the other lines that wouldn't move before, previously, was allowing for rotating presidency. And they managed to agree that on both sides. And then for it yet again to fall, for these talks to collapse, because of such an old argument, when they managed to make progress on a different one, it is quite sad. And I question what that means for the United Nations. I mean, this is one of the regions where they have one of the longest serving peacekeeping.
The longest running, I think. Yeah.
Exactly. And it is interesting to see what this is going to mean for the United Nations. It has been for such a long time a key priority, and perhaps should be, looking at it, you know, from further away, easier to resolve than unification of the Korean Peninsula or stuff like that. But it seems that it just doesn't go ahead.
Just very briefly, I want to say one thing. Andrew, you mentioned that you were there not so many years ago, going to the north of Cyprus.
A couple of years ago.
And Cyprus itself. I think I've done that trip as well, and you cross from Nicosia into northern Cyprus. You go from bustling, tourist-filled Nicosia with bars on every street and restaurants and packed and bustling. And then you cross that buffer zone and you step back to 1974.
It is really abrupt.
North of Cyprus is frozen in time.
It's a noticeable change of gear. It's quite weird.
And that is deeply unfair to the people who have lived there. That's what I felt when I went there. I thought, my God. And that's not necessarily the fault of the Greek Cypriots, I would say. I think the bloody-mindedness that comes from Ankara quite often is what has kept that place frozen in time. And unfortunately, you know, there are lots of people there who live in, you know, an unrecognised country. They do not have those opportunities to travel, to work, to go as broad as they would like to do. And that is a sad thing.
Just on that point that Chris raised about the bloody-mindedness of Ankara, it was quite striking. And you talked about the travails of the UN. Guterres said, oh, this doesn't mean other initiatives cannot be explored. And then you imagine him sort of trailing off. If you look at what the Turkish foreign minister said, he said, this shows the impossibility of reaching a settlement. He rather patronisingly referred to the UN as the good officer's mission. You know, you can see that there is an aggression, an aggressive rhetoric out of Ankara still on this issue. And I would agree with what Chris says. What worries me a little bit is that you often tend to find that the person who shouts loudest wins the day in these things. In this case, almost literally, because it turned into a shouting match. You've got things like the Greek Cypriots want to do extensive gas drilling off the island. That's opposed by Ankara. And it's those sort of additional questions, which weren't around in the 1970s, that I worry that Ankara, the foreign minister, Erdogan himself, may use to further muddy the waters. And that's kind of grist to the mill. That adds to the ability of those who maybe have a more nationalist stance to slightly skew the debate and make the public, who maybe are more receptive, look at it through a different prism.
Okay, we're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House, here with me, Andrew Muller, along with Tom Edwards, Carlotta Ribello and Chris Lord. Coming up next, Paris, Vienna and the peculiar difficulty of titling books.
Monocle has bureau around the world, in Tokyo, Hong Kong, Singapore, London, Toronto, and New York City. In New York City, our bureau chief is Ed Stocker.
You really can be anyone you want to be in New York. You can dress exactly how you like. You can act exactly how you like. There's that tolerance and acceptance that I think perhaps doesn't exist quite like it does in New York in any other city in the world. There's an energy and excitement to living here, and that's what makes it a great place to work in and to also live.
Hear from Monocle's editors and correspondents on the stories that matter and the places that matter every day on Monocle 24.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller, still with me are Carlotta Ribello, Chris Lord and Tom Edwards. And we'll look now at Paris, where this morning gendarmes descended on Porte de la Chapelle in the city's north and evicted an improvised community of roughly 2,000 migrants, which has developed in recent months. The evacuation of the tent city appears to have gone more or less peacefully, the migrants being taken to temporary accommodations elsewhere. Officials said the move was for the security and health of the migrants, as well as local residents. Tom, does the fact that these people, and there were a lot of them, camped out in the streets in the first place suggest that the procedures slash facilities weren't sufficient?
I think it probably does. And it's also instructive to look at how the people tasked and charged with making these big decisions talk about what they're actually trying to do. Now, it's interesting, obviously, we've talked a lot about, you know, Macron. He's come in, he's on the crest of a wave. It maybe gives him more license to be more aggressive over certain issues. I don't know. There's something fundamentally awkward about having a response, which I believe it's he's the interior minister, Gerard Collomb, who said we must respond to this crisis humanely and firmly. And I think that therein's the root of the problem. There's a desire to be seen to be welcoming and encouraging and inclusive, but there's a reality, which is that, you know, these camps are not fit for purpose. They're designed to accommodate 500 people. Quickly, they're accommodating 5,000. And I think officials who originally institute them and then are tasked with running them and managing them kind of lose track of the situation. They're clearly not fit for purpose, but then I don't really understand the idea of hoovering everyone up and spitting them out somewhere else. It just seems to be shifting the problem around, you know, sort of a bit like sweeping things up but never actually emptying the old dustpan.
Chris, is that what is going on here? Are they relocating the problem rather than solving it? Because obviously Parisian officials will be aware, like all European officials, that there is a certain amount of unease slash resentment, call it what you will, across the continent about the continuing incoming migrants, and when you have a tent city of several thousand people in your capital, that's a fairly visible, example of what it is that people don't like.
I suppose, I mean, you know, the question of this, is this just moving people around? I mean, to my mind, it comes back to a sort of element of definitions, you know, in as much as the Syrian war has been going on for 6 years now, and these people who are in France, who are not all Syrian, of course, but are coming from different parts of the world as well, from Northern Africa, from also other parts of the Middle East as well. But also, at the same time, I think there's still a feeling that these people will eventually go back. Like, this is sort of quite, for a lot of people's minds, certainly in Paris and France, I think a lot of people think this is something temporary, that people will eventually go back when things get sorted in Syria. But now this is 6 years later, and I think, therefore, it's got to that point where it's almost impossible now for the French government to sort of allow. I mean, this is an improvised community. This is a shanty town.
It is absolutely a shanty town.
In a French city. And I think that is, you know, in terms of what to do next, I mean, if we remember just back to the Macron campaign, you know, there was lots of talk about, you know, the jungle, what to do about the jungle in Calais. Well, of course, then the UK, we would allow that, make sure that those migrants could get to the UK if the UK is going to leave the European Union, etc., etc. We remember all this rhetoric that was talked about during the campaign. Now there's going to be a lot of pressure, I think, to see whether they can really act on that and actually do something about it. And I think also as well, you know, we do exist in this Macron era now, where there is so much talk, as Tom rightly said, about sort of like, you know, the niceties of language. But actually, like, what are you going to do when you have a shanty of several thousand people and you're going to displace them? What actually are you going to do?
I think essentially it is what you're saying. It is the language that is used and how, you know, the fact that Macron asked the interior minister to make this process asylum, the entire process more quick and more efficient. Yes, that's obvious. That's not something that should happen after you relocate nearly 3,000 people. And, you know, when we were having this discussion a couple of summers ago, when, you know, it was the peak of the migrant crisis here in Europe, you were seeing fences or the debate about fences rising up in Hungary, in Austria. Just this week, you saw military being deployed to the Italian-Austrian border over the migrant influx. We had a discussion here in this office about, has Europe forgotten that we have been migrants ourselves? We have been refugees. We have been in this place. So when we talk about language, for me personally, it is very difficult to understand, because it wasn't that long ago that we were in that position, we Europeans. And it also reminds me of something from earlier in the year. I know we're deviating a bit from the topic, but the chat that everyone was having around January, February, about sanctuary cities, after Donald Trump signed an executive order basically saying that, you know, was cutting federal funding to cities that wouldn't deport undocumented migrants. And what was interesting of the response then was to see how mayors rallied up against federal government. I remember, I believe it was the Boston mayor who said, I'm deeply against this and I will open the city hall. If you're afraid you're going to be deported, you can sleep here. And then to see this language coming from France, I don't know, I think I would expect more from a city hall in this instance.
Okay, well, let's take a look at another European city now, another European capital indeed, which is Vienna, which listeners are probably accustomed to thinking of as proverbially stolid, orderly, well-governed, and altogether one of the cities least likely to be added to UNESCO's list of World Heritage in Danger. Exactly such a thing may come to pass, however. UNESCO officials are meeting to discuss the impact of a 66-metre tower proposed at the edge of Vienna's old city. Tom, does one big tower, even if it's quite a big ugly tower, ruin Vienna for you?
Well, I'll be rather controversial. It probably doesn't ruin it for me, but I understand how it ruins it for many. Particularly,
that's not controversial. You can't say I totally see the other point of view. That's the very opposite of controversial.
Well, this is the rub. Look, I think cities are organic things. They're changing, and one of the amazing things about it is to see how old and new rub up against each other. Sometimes it's rather an ugly, it looks like a clash, almost a clash of cultures meeting. But that's where the interest lies for me. And I think there's a tendency amongst the small C conservative people, who often are the dominant forces in terms of town planning, to err on the side of caution. I think often it takes a generation or two to get used to it, but new buildings, new designs, whether it's going vertical or whether it's exploring brutalism, they add new facets even to parts of cities that some might say, oh, well, look, we need to protect it. We need to safeguard the sort of cultural heritage. I'm not in any way saying that we should rubber stamp acts of cultural vandalism and obscuring great and beautiful buildings by just whacking up something in front of it. But I think there has to be an acceptance that cities need to evolve. And if that means going up in some cases, I think it's probably acceptable. I don't know. I know certainly even here in London, there's a lot of resistance about the sort of newer high-rise culture. But it doesn't trouble me as it seems to trouble others.
Chris, is there a particular issue with towers in places where there aren't really towers? I mean, there are some cityscapes which are massively composed of skyscrapers, which are beautiful. They're magnificent. You think of Hong Kong, New York City, etc., etc., etc. But there are others where, if that's not, I guess, the common architectural vernacular, and one thinks cringing of something like the Shard here in London, which I, for one, think is horrible, it just looks weird.
I think it looks weird. I think I'll give you one anecdote. Recently, I was in Zurich just a few weeks ago, and in the middle of Zurich, quite a picturesque town there. When you go in the middle of it, there's this new tower right in the middle, which I only learned when I was there was a grain silo, surprisingly, built right there in the middle of Zurich. And it was built by referendum. So they turned around to the people of Zurich and said, do you want to have greater protection for your food stocks by having a big old grain silo in the middle of town? Now, the reason that I mention that is that within that, they all obviously voted yes. And they said, yes, we want to have a big grain silo. And it does disrupt the skyline of Zurich. In the Vienna's case, what concerns me here is how much actual complicity the people of Venice have had in this decision. Is this a purely real estate decision? Is this about building greater, better, more expensive and valuable to the city real estate in the middle of a very, very historic city? And for that reason, I think, is why one feels very concerned about towers, is because they are quite often a way, they're a maximalist statement in your city, and they're quite often what they're maximalizing is profits and the value of real estate. So that's what I think is a problem with towers, Andrew. But I think is if the people are part of it, they're talking about this being a great music venue. I don't think UNESCO, is its mission is to freeze cities in time. I think cities still need to move on and develop and change. But at the same time, if it's there and changing in the name of real estate and not in the name of the city, then I'm not with it.
Just quickly to add that Liverpool is in the same situation, exactly at the, in the same list that the committee is going to debate. And it's because of the waterfront development. It has nothing to do with a high rise. It has to do with this big riverside development that will bring residential blocks, office and some water front attractions, including a cruise terminal. So I think it really has to do with the place in the city rather than exactly what it is.
Okay, well, finally tonight, we must consider the shortlist for this year's Diagram Prize for Oddest Book Title of the Year, previously awarded to such classics as Highlights in the History of Concrete, Managing a Dental Practice, The Genghis Khan Way, and The Big Book of Lesbian Horse Stories. This year's contenders include The Commuter Pig Keeper, Nipples on My Knee, and my particular favourite, Rennick's Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors, The Premier Guide for Australian Pre-Decimal and Decimal Coin Errors. I like the Premier Guide. It suggests that there's many, many competitors for that type. There may be. It's not really my area of expertise. Do any of these sound especially enticing to the panel?
Nipples on My Knee sounds good.
No. Taken out of contest, that book is something. Nipples on My Knee and Love Your Lady Landscape, I have to say, those are definitely... Who comes up with those?
That's not even my favourite sort of horse-related title that you mentioned, The Big Book of Lesbian Horse Stories. I prefer Bombproof Your Horse, A Practical Guide, Andrew, which is one of my favourites.
Did they mean literally bombproofing, or were they talking in that case in the way you talk about making something, you know, invulnerable or hardy?
Well, why let that small detail get in the way?
Bombproof one's horse.
And that isn't even my favourite animal-related title.
What is your favourite animal?
I actually recently ordered this on Amazon, Knitting with Dog Hair. the front cover's a beagle wearing a knitted hat.
Knitting with Dog Hair sounds like a band from Portland who was signed by Sub Pop in about 1992 and dropped after two singles. Does anybody have a particular favourite weird book title that may or may not ever have been nominated for this award?
Tom, I think you've got a few. You just got a few in your file there, haven't you?
Well, Andrew Miller, I don't want to...
You have researched this extensively.
That was on wish list.
This is how I spend my days normally. For some reason, Andrew, I think this is some kind of self-help guide for younger people. But for some reason, when I saw the title of it, I thought that you might be the author. It's got a picture of a sad-looking child on the front. And the title is simply, It's Not Going to Get Any Better When You Grow Up.
That's an excellent... Well, I mean, you might as well teach them that lesson early on. My particular... It's not really that weird a title, but I do own a copy of it. It was given to me a very long time ago. It's a children's book released in the 1960s, written by an author called Elizabeth Guilfoyle, and it is called Nobody Listens to Andrew.
I almost feel like this program is proving that.
My point being that the actual moral of the book, at the risk of giving away the ending, the lesson it seeks to impart is that, yes, everybody should have listened to Andrew.
It's a controversial point.
It definitely is.
And not one that caught on, clearly.
No, but speaking of things that didn't quite catch on, hats off to the author of this one, which apparently didn't sell in big numbers, The Beginner's Guide to Sex in the Afterlife.
In the afterlife, or sex and?
In the afterlife.
Careful now.
I wonder why not many people bought
it. I like the fact that there's a beginner's guide suggests that there may have been an intermediate and advanced.
And then a final shout out, if I may, to C.H. Dalton, who's the author of what's billed as a national bestseller, A Practical Guide to Racism.
On that note, thank you to my guests today, Chris Lord, Carlotta Ribello and Tom Edwards. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Hunter Charlton. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next at 1900. Marcus Hippie is in with the menu. There's more on the day's main stories on the daily at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time on Monday, 1800 London time. I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening.